Welcome to the latest episode of Vox Talks Climate Finance with me, Tim Phillips, and hello again to my co-host, Alisa Klein-Ironhouse. Hello, Alisa.
Hi, Tim.
If we're going to get to net zero in time, economists argue that carbon taxation alone is the first best policy, but less than a quarter of emissions are subject to any carbon pricing. And even then, the price of carbon is set far too low. So can using climate finance get us to a socially optimal solution?
Today we are hosting Lasse Heyer-Petersen. He is a professor of finance at the Copenhagen Business School, and he served as the director of the American Finance Association and on the economic advisory boards of NASDAQ and FTSE. Welcome, Lasse.
Thanks a lot for having me.
First of all, to explain my introduction a little bit, if in a perfect world, carbon taxes were applied to all greenhouse gases and that price was the social cost of carbon, would we need climate finance at all?
No, in fact, we wouldn't need climate finance in that world. So just to understand that idea, if we had a carbon tax that everybody had to pay, then all the emissions would be costly for all polluters, and therefore they would take into account the pollution when they decided whether or not to pollute. And we would only have the pollution where the societal benefits are above the societal cost of doing it. And obviously that would mean a lot less pollution. It would be extremely profitable potentially to make green investments and have ways to circumvent that pollution or even capture the carbon from the air. All these things would be very economical for firms. Given that all the firms would then find it economical to do the environmentally right thing, we wouldn't need to also think about climate finance. And in fact, not only would we not need it, what my paper shows that it's sort of an obvious point that having both of these tools at the same time would actually be worse than just having only a carbon tax at the social cost of carbon. Because once you fully fix the problem with a carbon tax, having additional regulation and distortions would actually have us deviate from the first place solution.
But with the carbon taxes that we have now, which are not applied to all greenhouse gases and are often priced below the theoretically optimal carbon price, we are in a world of incomplete carbon taxation and we're fast running out of the carbon budget. So, Lasse, can climate finance help us get to net zero in time in this world of incomplete carbon taxation?
It can certainly help, at least in principle, to move us in the right direction, I think. My paper, and we'll get into the details, could be difficult to take us all the way to net zero only using climate finance, but it can help us at least move in the right direction. And in principle, if you can completely control the cost of capital, then under certain conditions, you could achieve many of the same things.
Let's talk a little bit about carbon pricing versus green finance. So how do you define climate finance, which you refer to as green finance, in your paper?
So the idea of a carbon tax is that if you burn fossil fuels, then that's associated with the tax. And then I distinguish from that what I call green finance, which is that firms that are polluting are not directly paying a tax, but they face a potentially higher cost of capital. So one, the standard mechanism is going via the cost of pollution. And then what I define as green finance is really trying to affect the cost of capital, whether it be that the brown firms, the polluting firms, face a higher cost of capital, or that the green firms, firms that are providing alternatives to pollution or even capturing carbon, they would face a lower cost of capital.
There are other forms of climate finance that are outside your definition, like sustainability-linked bonds, green bonds. Could they implement the social optimum that we're looking for in this world that we have with incomplete carbon taxation?
Actually, I would think of sustainability-linked bond as being one case inside of my framework. The way that different firms finance themselves is the way they raise capital is by issuing equity, could be issuing corporate bond, and or those corporate bond could be sustainability-linked bonds. So those are just one form of financing. And the idea behind sustainability-linked bond is that because these are financing green projects, that they have a lower cost of capital. And as I mentioned, that's part of the idea here, is that the green firms have a lower cost of capital, and then brown firms would not be able to issue those kinds of bonds, and therefore they would face relatively higher cost of capital.
Yeah, got it.
I guess the question was whether there might be forms of climate finance that are not part of your definition that still could get us to net zero or help us get to net zero in time. So would you think it's more accurate to call your paper cost of capital effects versus carbon taxation?
Certainly, my paper is about cost of capital. So you could call it, can global warming be fixed by managing the cost of capital rather than a carbon tax, if you prefer that title, but it gets a little long for a title.
So what we're talking about here is the possibility that there's a translation from carbon tax to green finance.
Right, exactly. What I'm trying to figure out is, can we achieve the same with a cost of capital mechanism, green finance, as we can with a carbon tax, but not just the direction, but also the magnitude. So sort of the starting point actually of this research is that it seems like most academic economists feel like we know the solution to climate change. We should have a carbon tax, and we even have an idea about how big it should be. So that's the contribution of Nordhaus and a number of other researchers. But then in practice, if you talk to policymakers, investors, and regulators, a lot of attention is actually switching to green finance. So for instance, even the central banks and regulators of the world, they have formed what they call the network of central banks and supervisors for greening their financial system. And a lot of the ideas that go into that is thinking about the cost of capital mechanism. And as you think about ESG investing, which is an enormous trend in the world of investing, again, these are investors thinking in terms of the cost of capital. And also the academic literature is very much pushing in that direction. The paradox is that we don't have such a strong theory for, first of all, does this cost of capital mechanism work? And to the extent it does, what's the magnitude we need? It's not just about saying, well, it sounds right that if green firms have a lower cost of capital, it's easier to build wind farms. And if brown firms have a higher cost of capital, it's more difficult to build brown investments. But how difficult should it be? So there's a magnitude question that we also need to address.
In your paper, you propose a way in which you can translate a carbon tax of a certain size, X, into how much the cost of capital would need to rise. If you set a given carbon tax, how can you then infer what the cost of capital would need to be to achieve the same effect?
First of all, I should preface that the general question of how you should do this translation can be quite complicated. So in the paper, I make a number of simplifying assumptions. And even under those simplifying assumptions, I show that only under certain conditions can you even make the translation. So I talk about in the paper, and we can come back to the case of stranded assets is a little bit different. But if we talk about the case where the translation can in principle be done, where in one very simple calibration, I find that for every dollar of carbon tax, the cost of capital of brown electricity firms should be raised by 0.1 percentage point approximately. So if we take the Nordhaus base case of now having a carbon tax of $43 per metric ton. Just think about the units, to me, are kind of an interesting base starting point. So economists who think about carbon taxes, they think the relevant unit are dollars per metric ton of carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. It could be pounds or euros, whichever is your currency. But let's just take dollars for this example. So $43 per metric ton, let's say. Financial economists and others who think in terms of the cost of capital, they think about percentage point per year. So how much should the cost of capital be raised in terms of percentage point per year? And so what I'm saying is that $43 per metric ton should roughly be translated to 4 percentage points per year. So in other words, if a brown energy firm would otherwise have a cost of capital, let's say, of 6%, then it should have a cost of capital of instead 10%.
You were talking about how there is this correspondence, but only under certain conditions. Can you tell me a little bit more about what these conditions are?
Yeah, so the first condition, which is implicit in everything I've said, is that you can indeed control the cost of capital.
Yeah.
This is certainly not an easy thing in the real world. So one way that, for instance, ESG investors or investors who are concerned with environmental and social and governance issues, if they lower their investment in brown thing and increase their investment in green, then green firms will potentially have their stock prices pushed up and their required returns reduced. So going forward, their cost of capital will be lower. But lowering them these as much as 4% or creating a difference between green and brown of 4 percentage points, that is already a very big difference, because the flip side of the cost of capital is what investors can earn. So if investors can earn an extra 4% for investing in a brown firm, that will be very tempting. And as the carbon tax should potentially be much higher, this spread should be higher still, and that will be very, very difficult to sustain. It will create a huge temptation for a lot of investors to go with a brown higher return investment. So that's one condition. The other condition I talk about in the paper is the case of stranded assets. Stranded assets is actually becoming a very standard terms in if you talk to policymakers about these types of regulations. But according to my referee, it's a completely non-standard term in the academic literature.
What? No, it's very well known. I don't agree.
but the way I define stranded assets, or one definition could be that's very academic, is that if under the first best solution or the social planner solution with the carbon tax, that certain assets should no longer be used. That in other words, coal, for instance, it's not only that we should stop investing in coal, that the coal we already have digged up or the coal energy power plants that we have, we should just stop using them because it's simply too polluting. You know, how can you implement that in practice if people already have the coal? Well, the idea is if you pay a carbon tax that is so high that the electricity you sell based on burning the coal, the price of the electricity, if that's lower than the carbon tax you have to pay, then it's still not profitable. So you don't want to do it. Again, if your net profit is the price you get for your electricity minus the related carbon tax, if that's negative, you're just going to stop doing it. But with this cost of capital mechanism, it's a little bit different. If you have an extremely high cost of capital for doing something like this, then you won't invest because the net present value of your investment will be negative. But to the extent you're still making a positive profit with your existing assets, you still want to sell, because if you're not paying a carbon tax and you're getting a positive price for that electricity, then you'd still want to do it. You'd let your assets depreciate. So over time, you would stop doing it, but you wouldn't stop immediately.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the green finance solution cannot fix stranded assets.
Exactly. And maybe to add to that, it's pretty well known that if you were to let the existing coal assets run until the end of their lifetime, right, that you let them naturally depreciate and you do not invest more, that alone would bomb us through the remaining carbon budget. And green finance wouldn't be able to alter that. Can you elaborate a little bit more on how your model works and how it's calibrated?
One example I talk about in the paper is the case of an energy company, let's say, which is burning fossil fuels to produce energy. And then we can think about what will the electricity price be with the cost of capital mechanism or with the carbon tax. So if you start with a carbon tax, the energy price that comes from producing energy will have, based on the marginal cost of the fuel you're burning, so whatever fossil, let's say oil or gas that you're burning, so that will affect the energy price, the electricity price that you're making, but also you have to be compensated for your cost of capital. And then there'll be a compensation for the carbon tax adjusted for what's called the fossil intensity. So how much carbon are you burning per kilowatt hour electricity that you make? So there will be those three components. Now, if you don't have a carbon tax, then the energy price will be artificially low in the sense that users of electricity are not really paying for the social cost of the implicit pollution that you have in that electricity. But then, because the cost of capital also affects the energy price, then if you raise the cost of capital, then you can achieve the same energy price as you would in the first best solution. And then what the paper does, it tries to, based on some hopefully realistic parameters, try to reverse engineer how much you have to raise the cost of capital in the world of green finance to match the energy price that you would have in a world of carbon taxes. And of course, then it depends on what carbon tax are you trying to match.
In your paper, you use as an example the $43 per ton of CO2 that Nordhaus once upon a time used in his work. But very recently, the Biden administration has updated its interim estimate of the social cost of carbon that used to stand at $52 per ton of CO2 to their new social cost of carbon number of $190 per ton of CO2 as their estimate of the social cost of carbon and thus the optimal price at which carbon should be taxed. If you were to use your translation formula of going from a carbon tax to cost of capital effects that could achieve the same amount, how much would cost of capital would need to rise if the cost of capital would want to mimic $190? And is that even possible?
The underlying theme in your question is we don't know exactly what the social cost is. And some people take that as an argument that, well, if we don't know the price, maybe we should just not do anything. But I think that's certainly the wrong conclusion. I think maybe you could say we don't know if it's 40 or 200, but we know something about the magnitude. I think it's not $1 per metric ton. It's probably not 1,000 right now. And we know that it should increase over time as we phase out carbon. Now, whether it's already 200 or 190 now, or it will become 200 over time either way. So it's certainly relevant to understand, can we translate 190, let's say. And so in my model, things are basically linear. So if you go from 43 to 190, that's basically a fivefold increase. So it was 24 before, it's around 20. And actually, if you do it a little more precisely, I guess it's around 18%.
Whoa.
So 18%, I think, is completely unrealistic. I think actually already 4% is getting outside what might be achievable. And so the reason I used 43 was to say that's reasonably conservative estimate and to illustrate that even with a conservative estimate, I think changing the cost of capital by that much will be very, very difficult. And going to 190 will be incredibly difficult using the mechanism of the cost of capital.
Turning this on its head, I suppose if we take the Nordhaus estimate at 43, but you did get some traction with that, could that then lead people to underestimate what had to be done?
I think the more general problem is that people see a carbon tax. They say, oh, it's something we have to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, actually, you have to remember that that money doesn't disappear, right? That can be used to lower other taxes. And I personally think that having a carbon tax of 190 or whatever the number is would be completely feasible if we did it globally. And I don't think it would lead to a huge recession. I think in the short term, it could be a shock for some sectors, but then people would adjust. And just like we saw when, let's say, Russia invaded Ukraine, people are very creative. They find solutions and people would be employed in other sectors and things would move just fine in a greener direction. But people still think taxes are unpopular. We're not doing it. And then people have been thinking, so let's do something else. We do green finance. We do all the central banks of the Western world and beyond are joining this network and ESG investing. And then people are thinking, oh, we are doing something. And I think the danger is more that people feel like, oh, we can just do something else. And it doesn't have a cost, but maybe it still helps. And let's not think about magnitudes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the potential interesting things that come out of my paper is try to say, is this alternative a solution that can bring net zero to fruition? And I don't think it is really. I think it is helping right now. So right now, I estimate that the carbon tax globally is probably only 1/110 of the Nordhaus number. And so at this point, the carbon tax and ESG investing or green finance might be actually doing as much good. So in that sense, it is potentially providing some real help. But a carbon tax, we could really potentially roll it out globally if we had the political will and increase it to an appropriate level where the green finance, I just don't see how we could really increase it to those levels.
I fully agree, Lasse, that that's a super important contribution of your paper because it's very important to understand what the limitations of green finance are. And if you had the impression that green finance could easily implement the same social optimum as a carbon price, then you would put all your eggs or many of your eggs in the basket of trying to promote green finance. But what your paper in essence shows is that we should not be naive. And if you actually study what it can do, it's much less than you might hope. It's very hard for green finance to replicate, let's say, $200 per ton of CO2 carbon price. And then there are these conditions that need to be fulfilled, like no stranding, which is not true. You can control the cost of capital, which is also not necessarily true. But anyway, suppose for a moment that the true global social cost of carbon is $200 per ton of CO2. Of course, it's uncertain, but let's take this number for illustrative purposes. And suppose that in world one, carbon is not priced at all. And suppose that in another world, let's call that world two, carbon is priced everywhere, but it's only priced at half of the social cost of carbon, namely at $100 per ton of CO2. So how does the degree of global carbon pricing, EA, how close it is to the social cost of carbon, matter for how much the cost of capital affects you need through green finance? So what cost of capital effects would you need in world one versus world two? So the reason I'm asking this question is, does the degree of carbon pricing that is present in the world, even if not complete, affect how much complementary green finance effects you need?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a great way to illustrate how the two mechanisms interact. So using your terminology, in world one, where there is no carbon tax, but there really should have been a carbon tax of $200. So there we have a $200 shortfall, if you will, that we have to fix using this cost of capital mechanism. And as we discussed earlier, to fix a $200 shortfall, we have to adjust the cost of capital by roughly 20 percentage points. But in what you call world two, you have globally a carbon tax of $100. So you, in some sense, fix the problem halfway. The
yes.
carbon tax should have been 200, but in your example, it's only 100. So there's a $100 shortfall. So now, since the carbon tax is doing half the work, we need the cost of capital mechanism to do the other half of the work. And so the cost of capital has to make up for the $100, and that corresponds to a cost of capital adjustment of 10 percentage points.
Exactly. And just to say, that of course means that to the extent that carbon taxation can be pushed to get closer to a world of complete carbon taxation, where carbon is priced to all greenhouse gases, or getting closer to reaching greater global coverage and also a higher price, then maybe actually there is a role for green finance, but only to sort of plug the gap. It seems unrealistic that green finance can carry the burden by itself.
Lisa,
yes.
Have you been writing exam questions?
I am in exam time, I'm sorry. It's true. This was literally last day of class of climate finance. So maybe I'm in the mood. So to stay within the carbon budget, fossil fuels will have to be stranded. You mentioned, Lasse, that it's necessary to control the cost of capital in order to be able to let green finance serve its role to help us implement the social optimum. But maybe in the real world, as you noted, it's not possible to fully control the cost of capital. Can green finance get close, at least, to implementing a social optimum if the cost of capital can only partially control but not fully?
A related question to my paper is, how much can you actually control the cost of capital?
Mm.
And there is a big literature now on trying to measure what some people call the greenium, which is the difference in cost of capital between green versus brown firms. And I actually recently finished a new working paper with three co-authors called In Search of the True Greenium, where we try to figure out empirically how large is the greenium at this point. And in that paper, we estimate that it might be around 0.5% per year at this point.
Very small.
Actually, it's larger than some theoretical models in finance would predict that you could control it with fairly large capital moves. But it's certainly much smaller than we need, even for the Nordhaus social cost of carbon, and certainly way smaller than the numbers from the Biden administration that you mentioned. Green finance can do something that is meaningful, but not get us anywhere near net zero.
When we talk about green finance, then we also talk about scope 1, 2, and 3, whether you're directly an emitter or whether you're indirectly because of the behavior of the people you do business with. Does your model, your research, imply who we should be targeting with the green finance?
Yeah, so as you say, scope one are the direct emissions, and scope two are indirect via electricity, and scope three are all indirect mechanisms. In the economics literature, actually, they don't talk about this so much there. I guess the implicit consensus is that you just need to tax the direct emissions, so scope one, and then it's going to filter through the supply chain and mm-hmm. they'll take care of the problem. But in the finance literature, people seem to assume scope two is better than one and three is better than two based on the idea that just the broader, the better. The more you hit with with this effect, the better. But that doesn't really have a theoretical foundation. So what I show in the paper is that you essentially need to tax directly or via the cost of capital channel every carbon emission once, not twice, not three times, but once. So in other words, you can do it with scope one, two, or three if you do it in a sort of theoretically consistent way where you hit every emission. So if you hit it at the level of scope two, you shouldn't also hit it at the level of scope one in some sense. But that is in the case where you can get to the first best, where you can implement a carbon tax. If you can only adjust the cost of capital too little and have at the same time too small of a carbon tax, then perhaps it could make sense to just go broad.
I see. So then it's in a way not efficient, but you're just trying to double tax to make up for the lack otherwise. You also study the global variation in carbon pricing and green finance. What do you find explains that global variation?
If you think about carbon taxes or carbon pricing, these new markets for carbon allowances and so on, it's basically a political decision. But if you think about it across countries, it tends to be countries with high carbon prices tend to be those that are wealthier, more democratic, those where the population is more knowledgeable about global warming, those that have less inequality, and those that had lower emissions per capita, perhaps before people became all very concerned with this, go back to 2000. So some of these, I think, are kind of intuitive. Certainly, the wealth of the country seems to be an important determinant. If you look at green finance, also tend to be something that is more prevalent in wealthier countries and more democratic countries.
Is climate finance a complement to carbon taxation or a substitute for it?
They can complement each other, but you don't need both if you can do either one fully, but you can also do some of one and some of the other.
So Lasse, of course, I agree, given the results of your paper, that green finance via cost of capital effects can ultimately only have a limited impact on implementing the social optimum. And for that reason, a carbon tax seems sort of more potent to achieve the magnitude that we need. But in some sense, of course, there's another way in which climate finance could be perhaps equally potent as a carbon tax. And that would be if the governments would use subsidies to implement blended finance so that governments subsidize the build out of renewables and also subsidize the early closure of fossil fuels to try to crowd in capital markets who can then just come in based on their traditional risk return consideration. And this is one of the ways in which some scholars, including my colleague Patrick Bolton, but also Caroline Flummer, argue that actually climate finance could reach scale, but that's climate finance enabled by governments that help reduce the cost of capital. So would you agree that under this definition of climate finance, actually climate finance can be pretty potent?
I think it's certainly something that's worth studying in detail and trying to figure out the mechanism and exactly when it can work and the magnitude that we need.
Yeah, so we need trillions. That's what we know. I think the question is whether governments are willing to implement blended finance in a way that is conducive to capital markets to come in.
So Lasse, let's sign off with a clip of Antonio Guterres at the United Nations.
In short, our world needs climate action on all fronts, everything, everywhere, all at once.
Everything, everywhere, all at once. Is that a prescription you agree with?
I think it's a great catchphrase, but if we think about economic theory, actually all we need is the right tool everywhere at once. Uh-huh. One tool everywhere at once, namely a carbon tax at the right level everywhere in the world. If we cannot do that for political reasons, not for economic reasons, I think, but for political reasons, perhaps it makes sense to then instead try everything everywhere all at once. But it's important to really focus on tools that could bring us home and to fix the global warming for good.
just to say, I think for that reason, your paper is important because it does study theoretically how would green finance complement carbon taxation when you move away from approach of one tool everywhere at once to using multiple tools everywhere at once. So thank you, Lasse, and thank you, Tim.
Well, thanks both of you.
And the reference, Lasse's paper, is called Carbon Pricing versus Green Finance. It is super clear, so if you read it, you too will be able to answer Elisa's exam questions.